My name is Gene, and I, too, am an alcoholic.
Hi, Gene.
It was interesting counting up how many newcomers there are and how reluctant they are to get their name on the board. But I was thinking, 20-odd newcomers at this meeting, I can remember, and I'm not trying to impress you with longevity, but I can remember when 20 people would have been called a roundup in AA. You know? So that's a hell of a thing to see that many people. And I noticed my little friend Kathy over there wasn't the last one this week. She made it, pretty good. And Curly down here at the end finally got up enough nerve to say it. Welcome, Beth, to have you here with us, Get a haircut. You look like a bum. I mentioned at the first meeting here 2 weeks ago that I have had always had trouble with education because I don't have any education, and that long words always confused me and multi-syllable words confused me, and that I have never been able to read intelligently, and I still can't really read too well. So some people wondered, how I became able to grasp the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe I told you then or some other place that I had to see the program Alcoholics Anonymous in action. The words really didn't mean that much to me. The first time I read this book, I understood about 25% of it, because anything that got past two or three syllables, was very difficult for me, and I just didn't know what it meant, and my ego didn't permit me to run around asking questions because I was afraid you'd think I was dumb and ignorant. So I stayed drunk for 6 years with that kind of an attitude. And then finally, as I just said, I found myself in the company of men and women who walk like they talk. There's an old saying in our program, that you can't walk the walk until you've talked the talk, or you can't talk the talk until you walk the walk, The words meant nothing to me. The actions did. It's just as I was at a meeting this afternoon, and we were talking about this, and I hope I don't offend anybody here, and I certainly don't offend Curly down there, Everybody gets haircuts on Saturday, But, I hear a lot of people getting up and saying, well, my name is Jim, and I'm a grateful alcoholic, And a lot of people say, oh, I'm so grateful for AA and all that. Words don't mean crap to me. That saying you're grateful, you might as well just shut up, The only way you express gratitude in this program is through action. I want to see you express your gratitude, pick up a couple of chairs, make a little coffee, get here early, stay late, help a newcomer, give somebody a ride home. That's how you express your gratitude in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what I had to do. I had to see people who'd done those things. Now, I made mention that the first 6 years of my attempt at recovery was rather difficult because I just couldn't seem to understand what in the hell we were talking about. And I couldn't really understand the fifth chapter of this book. As simple as it is now, as I look at it now, it seems so simple, so simple. But yet at one time it appeared to be almost insurmountable to me. I couldn't believe that line, Rarely have we seen a person fail. And I said, like hell, stick around, and watch me, pal, and you'll see it. And then the part, there are those who are constitutionally incapable of being. That was me, I was ready to put up my hands, And I even tried to get myself under the heading of those with grave emotional and mental disorders, but they screwed that up, They said, but they can recover if they have the capacity. So, my God, I was having a hell of a time with this, and I just couldn't figure out what I had to do. Now, most of my program, my own personal program, the way I have worked it, I have associated, sort of like they teach in school today, word association. When I hear a word, I associate it with something in my past. And just like in this book, when I read a chapter or learn a lesson from this book, I associate it with something in my past, and that way I understand it a little bit better. And how lucky and how fortunate I have been. Because, I have done many things in my life, and And most of them came up in the red, you know. I failed, you know, miserably. Because I was trying to do a lot of these things and drink at the same time. I can remember some of the things that I did. I can remember when I came home from the war, you know, I was going to be a regular Sam Spade, you know, a private eye type guy with a trench coat and a little hat, you know, and women coming through the doors and the bottle down in the desk and all of that crap. Well, as close as I got to that was a skip tracer for a finance company, you know. And I didn't do a good job there because the first case they sent me out on, you know, was up in a little town in Wisconsin called Clinton, Wisconsin. And I had to repossess a young lawyer's car who was about 5 months behind in his payments. And this was Christmas week. And they sent me out, you know, and I had my trench coat on and my hat and had a couple of belts and, you know, all a pack of Camels. You got to have Camels all the time. And a busted old Zippo from the war. And, you know, I played the whole role. And through my super sleuthing, I got to Clinton, Wisconsin. I found Clinton, Wisconsin. Population about 67, you know. And I had a super sleuth around there to find out where this guy was. And I located him, and he was in the tavern. And that wasn't hard for me to do because there was only one tavern in the town. As a matter of fact, there was only one building in the town. And his office, or what was supposed to have been an office, was up over this tavern. And my super sleuthing found out when I got to his office that they told me he was down in the tavern. So I super sleuthed down to the tavern, and I put the collar on him, you know, while he was up at the bar. And he was a young G.I., just, you know, like I, he's back from the war, too, and he just hung up a shingle, and he was just trying to put his feet back down on the ground, too. And he was a hell of a nice guy, hell of a nice guy. And he understood my position. This is my first case, you know, my first job, and there was nothing personal in it. I was just sent up there to get his car, you know, or four payments, you know. And he said, well, I ain't got four payments, you know. I haven't had a case or nothing since I got here. And the few little things I've had I haven't been paid for yet. And geez, I'm a soft touch anyhow, you know. And I said, well, hell, you know. And he said, no, he said, don't feel sorry for me. He says, I understand you got to do a job. And he says, just to show you there's no hard feelings, he says, let me buy you a drink. And I said, well, that's decent of you, you know. So he bought me a drink, and then I bought him one. And then the house bought us one for Christmas, and somebody in the booth bought us one. And then he figured he should buy another, and I bought another, and I decided to let him have his car. And I got back to the finance company, and they told me to, you know, get lost, which I did, you know. So I fell horribly there. There was another instance where I went into the saloon business. A lot of people know this when they hear me tell my story, you know. The epitome of insanity, you know, the alcoholic. I literally bought a saloon in Chicago because I thought that would help me stay sober. Now, that's the truth. Because I knew a guy on AA. I knew a guy on AA that owned a saloon. And he had about 9 years of sobriety at that time. And I used to ask him, I said, hey, Gannon, how the hell can you stay sober and own a saloon? He says, it's easy for me. He says, maybe easier than you. And you know, there's a lot of good logic in what he said. And I said, well, how could that be? He says, well, every morning, and he had a Skid Row saloon. He said, every morning, he says, I get a good chance to look at what I could become if I decide to drink again. And that made sense to me. It made so much sense to me that I bought a saloon. Didn't draw a sober breath for 2 years, you know. So I failed at that. I booked horses for a while, too, and I didn't do too good in that either, you know. And I went out of town on a Rock Island freight with that deal, you know. And, then some of you know I used to race harness horses, and I didn't really, you know, didn't do too bad there. Of course, I was drinking, and you can't do too good when you drink in there. A lot of people to this very day that say that I might have done quite well, you know, if I had left the booze alone, but I didn't. But I wouldn't want you to think my whole life, you know, was a total failure. That wouldn't be fair to my mother and father, you know. There is an area, you know, if I had to be pinpointed down where somebody said, you know, what did you succeed in the most, you know? Where did you make your mark? Well, I would have to say without any question, you know, in the construction business, because I was born and raised in the construction business. I don't know if I said it here in either of the last two meetings. I'm a stonemason by trade, you know. I carry a union card, a gold card now, because I'm a lifetime member, paid-up member. And I'm a former business agent for the Bricklayers, Mason, Plasters Union in Chicago, Illinois. And during my life in the construction business, I have been involved in building some of the biggest buildings at that time in the Middle West. I've worked at a lot of the major universities, Purdue University, Northwestern, University of Wisconsin, Illinois, Northern Illinois, and DeKalb. I was just talking to the gentleman before. So I'm not talking about building houses, you know. And I only knew this business not because I went away to college to study it, because if I had gone away to college to study it, obviously I would have been a total failure at it. I was indentured to it early in my life. My first recollection of being in the construction business was about age 12, because my grandfather was in the construction business, and just sort of the medieval caste system in our family, you know, grandfather, father, son, and right on down the line. And when it came my turn and all of my male cousins' terms, down we went, you know. And my first introduction was on Saturday mornings. That was in the days of the 44-hour work week. And construction men worked till noon on Saturday. Not for any kind of overtime. Work week was just 44 hours. So all of us young Duffies, the just the 12 and 13-year-olders, would go down there and act as the water boys on Saturday. Climb up and down the ladders and around the scaffolding, bringing pails of water and a dipper to the various stonemasons and the guys that were working around the job. Probably the next year, by the time we were 13, we would have to go down to Grandpa's jobs after school and all day on Saturday. And by this time, he was teaching us how to carry the hod. That's something they don't do anymore, where you carry it up on your shoulders full of plaster and cement or whatever. He taught us how to build scaffolding, you know, and how to mix the mortar and how to pile bricks and things like that. And then occasionally, maybe when we were about 14 years old, if we got caught up on everything, he'd take one or two of us off on the corner someplace where wasn't going to show that much, and he'd begin the process of teaching us the trade, you know. He'd teach us how to spread the mortar. You know, I spread mortar for 9 months before I ever picked up a damn brick. That's how my grandfather thought all of us. You know, and that gets a little tiresome, just going like that and spreading the mortar. But by the time I got through, I could furrow it out just like that with a blink. So I knew my trade well. I knew my trade well. And I don't say that to be braggadocious. I just say it to you because that's how it was taught to me. And when I came back from the war, I was a full journeyman by now. I had served a 4-year indentureship to my grandfather as an apprentice. And there was a big boom on in the Middle West for construction. Well, all over the world, for that matter. And in the construction, the building code is ideal for bricklayers because the first 12 feet of any building has to be a 16-inch brick wall. So everything in the Middle West is brick, 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 stone, 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 stone. So guys like me who were actually at a premium, there was a shortage of bricklayers. Nobody had anticipated the kind of a boom that we were going to have. So we sort of wrote our own tickets and promotions, you know, were rapid because, you know, there were too many of you to pick from, you know. And all there was more apprentices at one time in the Bricklayers Union than there were journeymen. And that was from a period of time from 1947 to 1951. It probably never will happen again, but it was true then because they were trying to make up this shortage of men. So I learned my trade very, very well under a lot of supervision, and I have never been afraid to build a building, and I've been proud of a lot of them I've built. I've made mistakes just like anybody else, but if you had to pin me down, that's what I did best. And when I say that's ironic and I'm fortunate, it's because of what I finally had to do when I came to you. When I finally recognized that my life was becoming unmanageable and that I was powerless over alcohol, and when I took my fourth step, which was long before I come to AA, I realized something had to be done. Now, I noticed some of you looking at me quizzically when I mentioned the fourth step. I always like to bring that out. People tend to make the steps difficult, and they're not difficult. As a matter of fact, you've taken a hell of a lot of them before you even get here. You know, you had to take the fourth step to come to AA. Because the fourth step is nothing more than an inventory of good and bad in your life. And that's what brought you to AA. Somewhere along the line, you took a look at yourself. And you didn't like what the hell you saw. You didn't like where you were heading. And you said, maybe I ought to do something about this. And some of us came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, when it came that time for me, I came here, as I said, and I tried to read your book, tried to read your literature. I tried to sit up front and appear to be intelligent. I was a great nodder. Yeah. You can always tell the dumb people in AA. They're the ones that sit there going, because I did that for 6 years. Didn't know a goddamn thing he was saying, but everybody thought I did, you know, and I looked good. I looked good. But finally, you know, I had had it. I had reached that depth, that bottom we talk about where I had to know. I had to know. And I went to the right guy. I went to the right guy. And I asked him, I said, Bob, for Christ's sake, what the hell is the matter with me, you know? I think I'm doing everything I'm supposed to be doing. I'm trying to do everything I'm supposed to be doing. I really want to stop. And I said, why do I have so much difficulty? And he says, you're not really working this program as it has been outlined, do you? And I says, I don't understand that damn outline, you know. And he said, you know, Duff, it's no different than what you do for a living. I thought for a minute. He says, what the hell are you talking about, what I do for a living? You know, by this time I was a building superintendent in charge of building a lot of buildings, you know. And I didn't think that had anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he pointed out something to me that a lot of people really aren't aware of in the beginning. And I really want to make sure you newer people know this tonight. You know, I used to think Alcoholics Anonymous was a penance program or a punishment, you know, for drinking, you know. That this was a program where you came because you couldn't drink. Now, that's a lie because alcoholics can drink. That's been our problem, you know. And AA is not a penance. It's not a punishment. It's exactly what our late co-founder Bill Wilson wrote about when he wrote the book. And please, new people, remember this. Alcoholics Anonymous is a new way of life. A new way of life designed for people who choose to live a life without drinking. That's what it is. It's not a punishment. It's not a penance. And if you practice these concepts in all of your affairs or make an attempt at them, I assure you, and a million other members will assure you, that you are about to embark on the greatest adventure in your life. Just have faith in us that that's true. But you see, I didn't understand that. I didn't understand that. He tried to tell it to me. And then I said, what are you talking about? It's like what I do for a living. He said, well, Duff, you know, building sobriety is just like building a building. And I thought about that. I said, well, hell, I know all about building. And he said, well, you don't really do this any different. He said, what's the most important part of any building? Well, anybody in the construction business here knows that right off the bat. Foundation. The guy over there said it right before me. Foundation. And why is the foundation the most important part? Well, just look up the definition of the word foundation in any dictionary. It tells you foundation. The part that all of the other parts rest upon. Lousy foundation, lousy building. Boom. Zero. Out. Finished. Collapse. Done. So he says, that's what you've got to do. You've got to build a foundation so that you could put your life back together again. He says, AA is the foundation for your life. AA is not going to tell you what to do with your life. That's your God-given right. But AA is what prepares you for the experience of living. And he says, what do you have to have? What's the utmost thing you have to have to build a foundation? Well, hell, I was writing my own ball game now. Hell, I could fire the answers right back at this guy, and I began to feel comfortable. I said, well, any dummy knows that. He said, what? I said, it's got to be dry. He says, that's right. He says, you got to be dry, Duff. You don't pour concrete into water, do you? And I said, hell no. And he says, well, come on. He says, why don't you approach this program as though you're going to build the most important thing in your life? And he says, hey, have you got any argument? Isn't it the most important thing in your life? He says, hey, Duff, do you realize that this might be the only time you're ever going to get to build? This might be it? The one and only? So what are you going to do, Duff? Are you just going to Joe McGee it? You're going to go out there and half-ass try to do it all by yourself? Or because it's the most important thing in your life, are you going to take all of the help that's available? All of the craftsmen, the masters that are around, and let them help you put this thing together? Because, Duff, it might be the only chance you're ever going to have. What do I do? He says, what's the first thing you do anytime you build a building, Duff? I said, well, Christ, you got to want to do it. He says, that's it. You got to want to do it. You got to have a desire to build a building. Somewhere along the line, you know, you think it over a couple of martinis at lunch down in the shop or some damn place, and you say, let's build a building. Now, I don't know what the hell you want out of life. That's your own right. I don't know whether you want to build a two-room bungalow, 180-room condominium, a ranch-style home in the Sierras, or just a shack up in the Russian River. That's your right. But we all have to build a foundation. We all got to have something to sit it on. And now we've got the desire, but that's not enough. You can't just have the desire. So you sort of do those things that a lot of us did in our younger days. I don't think I'm unique. I can remember, you know, when I first got married right after the war, when the bucks were hard to come by, and, you know, and you're struggling. Three little duffies fooling around my ankles all night, wondering how the hell I'm going to do this, and pay this, and the hell are you laughing at? You got one on your back now, Gene. And then you and the missus occasionally, maybe on some of them evenings, you get the kids into bed early, you know, and you sit up there and you're trying to work the budget out, how to make $42 pay $81 worth of bills and things like that. And then you sort of dream a little bit. Oh, I used to love that. You know, we used to draw blueprints on a little loose-leaf notebook paper or backs of paper sacks, little square blueprints of the house we were eventually going to build and have for our own, you know. And mother would draw one, you know, and her square, she'd have 18 bedrooms and 39 closets, you know. And the mine would have no closets, you know, no kitchen, a bar on every floor, 9-car garage with a 68-foot workbench, you know. But they were all just the dreams. They were the things we dreamt about and we wanted, you know. And hey, there's nothing wrong with that. Oh, occasionally, you know, we'd even spring for a buck, run down to the local magazine shop, you know, and get one of them 100 best plans, better homes. Look at it. Yeah. Better homes and gardens, you know. And this was going to be it. God, it was a hell of an experience. But, you know, common sense says, hey, you and a wife can't go out there and do that. You know, them little squares, that's all they are, that paper. So smart people who are about to embark on the most important venture in their life would take all of these little ideas that they got, all these little desires, wants, and needs, and they take them to somebody who knows what it's all about. Somebody who can take all of these dreams, these needs, these wants and desires, and put them down in a workable plan. Maybe even construct a small model to show you exactly what it's going to look like if you follow the plan. They call that guy architect. Architect. Master builder. The only guy you and I know who's never made a mistake. God as I understand him. Master builder. And that's the guy for me and you. He says, I've got the plan. Here it is. Rarely have we seen a person fail. Now I want you to follow this plan. If you do this, then you're going to get this as an example. Here's a little model over here. There's another model there. Here's a model over here. I got lots of little models for you. If you want to look at them. Some of them are 30 days old. Some of them are 30 years old. They all work. You figure, well, you know, this isn't such a bad deal. But God says, I got to go now. Hey, what do you mean you got to go? Oh, yeah. He says, I can't be screwing around with you, you know. Yeah. I've got a whole lot of jobs going on all over hell. I didn't think you'd catch that. Is I got some in Germany, some in Rome, some up in the Great Northwest, some in Cupertino. I've got them all over hell. And he says, furthermore, he says, you've got nobody to do the work yet. You've got to get yourself a general contractor. Got to get a builder. Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, how would you pick out a general contractor if you were going to build a house? Say I just dropped a bundle of cash in your lap right now and said, go build a house tomorrow. How would you get a general contractor? Would you just look in the San Jose directory tomorrow and yellow pages, and if you happen to be Irish, it says Shamrock Builders. That good enough for you? A1 contractor, you buy that? Best builders? Come on. No. Anybody that's involved in building something as important as your life, better take a little bit more care than that. You know how I would do it? I'd pick out a couple of contractors. Then I'd say, fellas, I want to see some of the work you've done. I'd like to see something you built 47 years ago. I want to see what it looks like today. Show me some of the stuff you've worked on 45 years ago, 40 years ago, 35, 30, 25, 20, 15, 10, and 5. And how about what are you doing now? Now, that'd sort of wipe out a whole lot of people in that yellow section, you know. Just like in the field of alcoholic recovery, that would wipe out a whole lot of people, too. Except one. There'd be one that would stand alone. I could show you 47 years of work, still standing, strong, not crumbling, not weak, and show your other examples right on down the ladder and a lot of things that they're building right now. I'd call my general contractor Alcoholics Anonymous. Now I'm about ready to go. Hey, God! Well, I suppose I can get away with anything as long as... Who are you? Engineer? What do you mean you're the engineer? Yeah, I work for God. I'm here to make sure you follow the blueprint. I don't want you going too high, too low, too much to the right, too much to the left. I'm going to see that you follow that book. In AA, we call that guy sponsor. Sponsor. He's the guy that tells you when you're too high and too low and too far and too out. Hold it, you're going too much. You're not going enough. Get up, get out, down. Well, that ain't bad, you know. But who the hell is going to do the work? I don't have any workers yet. I got to get a crew. That's what I got to get is a crew. Now, how do you pick out a crew? Well, I have a lot of experience in that. I always use an example in Memphis, Tennessee, because it's just a little fond memory I have. Near the end of my construction days, I had progressed to a situation where I really had a snap job, really. When you say general masonry superintendent, that was just a title. The guys that really done the job were sort of underlings to me. They knew more about it than I did, but I had to... As a result of the experience, I had the title. So, some of the duties that my job entailed was that I usually went to the job site maybe 2 weeks before we even started. And that would be to arrange credit at the ready-mix plant, at the concrete block suppliers, the hardware stores, the lumber yards, and then initiate the skeleton crew. Because I was the masonry superintendent, that meant that I hired all of the men who were going to do the masonry work and a small skeleton crew of carpenters who would put up the footings and the batter boards and things like that. Now, in Memphis, the deal sort of went like this. Well, first I should tell you, we had just got finished a job in Hightstown, New Jersey. We built a building for RCA Corporation. And we had been up in Hightstown, New Jersey for about a year, which meant every weekend we was hopping over to Manhattan, you know, hip, slick, and cool. And And in those days, I had a 28-inch waist and a head of hair, you know. And I had bought one of them Lucky Luciano black silk suits, you know, and I had the Capone fedora. Oh, Jesus, you know, oh. Not really the thing you'd wear in Memphis, Tennessee, though. And I went down to Memphis, you know, all dolled up, my black shirt, white tie, you know. And of course, on the train, where I always used to go in those days, and I got myself gassed up on the train. And I checked into the hotel, I'll never forget, that old-fashioned hotel had one of the big birdcage-type elevators in it. And I spent many an afternoon sitting there in the lobby. Well, what I really remember about that hotel so much is, you know, I got on the elevator, and there was a woman elevator operator. God almighty, she was 9'6", you know. Must have weighed about 61 pounds, and she had red hair. Looked like a thermometer, you know. And I'm on the elevator, going all the clicking, all, you know. I said, honey, where's all the action in Memphis? And she said, it all depends what kind of action you're looking for. She said, you looking for gambling or women? I said, women? She said, honey, you looking right at it, you know? I'll never forget that. Had nothing to do with AA. So here I am. And I figured that we needed about 400 bricklayers to do these two jobs. We always done two jobs wherever we went. My company was sort of a crooked company. If any of you have ever been in the Memphis Naval Air Station, you'll notice that all the buildings down there are built out of red colonial brick. You go downtown and you will notice that the Sears and Roebuck store and office building is also red colonial brick. All paid for by the United States government. They were all supposed to have been used out there at the Naval Air Station, but It's done all over. So I had to get about 400 bricklayers. Now, when you're an out-of-town contractor, and I know you builders in here know exactly what I'm talking about, and we were union contractors, so we had to follow a lot of rules, you know. You hit a town like San Jose, and let's say there's 600 bricklayers in the local in San Jose. Well, common sense tells you that the best bricklayers in that local are already working. The local contractors got them tied up. The guys that are hanging around the hall are not bad or the worst or anything like that. They're just not as good as what we call the stars. So you have to accept the fact that wherever you go into a small town, the stars have already been taken. Unless you're sharp. And we were sharp. We always paid 50 cents above the scale. And we always give them Saturdays for overtime. That takes a lot of the stars away from the local contractors, you know. So you have to shoot for angles like that. But most of all, you got to do business with the business agent. That lazy-ass son of a bitch, you know. Now, you walk into his office, you know, and right away the fight's on. Him against you, you know. He's going to outfox you, and you're going to outfox him. See, he's thinking this. Well, here's an out-of-town contractor. He don't know anybody around here. This is a time to unload all of the bums that I've got. I'm going to give them to him so that at least he'll get one job this year. And I'm standing on the other side of the desk saying, this fat son of a bitch thinks he's going to give me all of the bums that he's got in this town. So we have to play our little game. Now, when you say you want 400 bricklayers, all he's obliged to do is send you out 400 men who have a little green book that says, paid-up member, International Brotherhood of Bricklayers, Masons, and Plasterers. That says he's a bricklayer. That's all it says. It doesn't mean he is, and it doesn't say how good he is. It's just like, did you ever wonder when you're in a doctor's office sometime? You look up there on the wall, they got all this certificates, right? I was in one not too long ago. And he graduated from Harvard School of Medicine. And I told him, I says, Doc, you know, I'm pretty impressed with that. He says, oh, yeah, I graduated from the School of Medicine. He says, I graduated the year they had the biggest class they ever had. I said, really? I said, how many? He's about 1,900. I said, 1,900 of you got them certificates? Were you number one or number 1,900, Doc? And it's sort of that way with bricklayers, you know? It would be just like, you know, if a stranger walked into this hall right now. Somebody said, that's an AA meeting over there. Those are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. A stranger would walk in here and say, oh boy, this is where the answer is. Really? How do you know whether you're sitting alongside a Paz or some other jackass over here? Or somebody with 20 years of sobriety or somebody with 20 minutes? How do you know one of the people in here that you think is a respectful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because it says so on the door, doesn't have a bottle in his pocket? Or is going to drink right after this meeting? Or has been drinking before the meeting? You don't know. And it's the same thing on Monday morning when this guy sends you 400 bricklayers. Here they come. Oh, my God. You know, some of them are in pickup trucks. Some of them are walking. Some get off of buses. Some roll in. Some got tools. Some ain't got tools. Some know where they are. A lot of them don't know where the hell they are. But they all got that little book. It says, I am a bricklayer. Well, most guys like me, you usually set up what I used to call the audition room. That's usually the longest, straightest wall that you can find, as far back in the building as you can get, so that nobody will ever see it once it's built. And it looks sort of stupid. You throw about 400 guys up there. Christ, they're stumbling over each other, falling all over each other. But you say, lay brick, fellas. Now, if you know your job, all you've got to do is sort of walk behind them like a gun bull in a gun tower in San Quentin, you know, something like that. And you can tell the way they spread the mortar, whether he's a bricklayer or not, the way he furrows it out, the way he snaps a brick with his trowel, holds his level, condition of his tools. All of these are the signals that tell you if this guy is any good or if he's not any good. If he's pushing them bricks out to the line and hell, mortar's falling all over. Hell, you don't need that guy. Man, you're building something pretty important. So you just tap him on the shoulder and say, sorry, Charlie, I'm building something pretty important. I can't use you. Go down to the shanty, pick up your 2-hour show-up time, and thanks for coming out. And maybe you got to go through that whole line and get rid of half of the guys they've sent down. Which means you're going to have to go back down to that union hall again tonight. Now you only need 200. So he says, okay, I'll send you 200 more tomorrow. And you go through the same process the next day. And you get rid of 100 of them. Wednesday night, you go down for 100 and come back on down through the week. And if you've got any kind of luck and any kind of pizzazz and know-how at the end of the week, you've selected the 400 men you think can do the job. That's no different than what you do when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you come into a meeting tonight and you look around. You meet a few people, you shake a few hands, you listen to a few people talk. Then you go to another meeting tomorrow night and meet a few people down there. Different meeting maybe on Wednesday or maybe on Thursday, you come back to the one you was with on Monday. But by the end of the week, because you've been going in and out of all the meetings, you know who's walking like they talk. You know who's sober, you know who's coming back, who seems to know what the hell this program's all about. And that's the kind of people you begin to hang around. Now you got your crew and you're ready to go to work. But only a damn fool would try to run 400 bricklayers, try to do it all by himself. Only an idiot would do that. Now all men have all different formulas. Mine was taught to be my grandfather and he always kept it in the 20s. Everything was in the 20s. He's for every 20 bricklayers you got, you get a foreman. So if you got 400 bricklayers, that means you're going to have 20 foremen. So that means I've only got to tell 20 guys what to do. And each one of them has to tell 20 guys what to do. That way we're going to get the job done. And how do you pick out a foreman? Because he's your buddy? Is that why you pick him out? Because you're going to bed with his sister? Or he lent you $20? Or he's Irish? No. You pick out a foreman just like you pick out a winner in Alcoholics Anonymous. You pick out a guy that you can depend on. He's always there on Monday, you know. He don't seem to have that flu. He never asks anybody to do something that he hasn't done himself. You look at his tools. They're clean, they're neat, and they're kept in condition. He walks like he talks. He's a leader. A trusted servant. So now you get your foreman and you're really ready to go. Except there's obviously something missing. Where's the tool? Don't have any tool? Oh, here they come! Big semis start backing up down the road. Big blue and yellow ones on there. Rowley Burst Corporation. The tools are here! There's the mortar mixers. There's the wheelbarrows, the scaffold plank, the jacks, the air hammers, the dampers, the hose. Everything you're going to need. Get them off of the truck. They're no good on the damn truck. Get them in there in that shanty where we can get at them. Now, do you think on a good construction job they just take all them brand new tools and hang them up in the shanty and just leave them there? Like some of us did when we bought them books in the beginning. Oh, I bought all them books. Jesus Christ Almighty. I had books and praying hands and crap all over the place. Never took them off the shelf. Never took them off the shelf. You got to get out there and you got to use them tools. And you got to take care of them tools, you know. I used to respect good laborers. And any of you guys are laborers or have laborers working for you, you know exactly what I'm talking about. I think the greatest artist in the construction field is the professional ditch digger. And I say that in all honesty. You've never really seen art until you've seen a real ditch digger dig a ditch by hand. Nobody else will ever touch his shovel. That's his shovel. He always has a little roof shingle in his back pocket. That's to clean the shovel off at night, guys. You know. The trenches are just as neat. Almost as though you're baking a cake, you know. And that's the kind of guys you got to have. Guys that take care of the tools. Wheelbarrows need air in the wheels. You put the air in them. You wash them out after they're full of mortar and cement so that it doesn't get hard and cake in there. You keep your mixers clean so that the first thing in the morning they start right up. You don't stand there trying to figure out why it won't start. You got 400 bricklayers at $10 an hour standing up there laughing at you. No. The tools in our program are very obvious. We all have our own sets of tools. 12 steps of recovery, 12 traditions, serenity prayers, phone calls, anything that, whatever the hell it takes. Those are the tools. But I repeat, they ain't worth a damn if you don't use them. Now you're ready to go to work. And right now is when about half of your laborers are going to quit. Right now is about when half of the people who come to Alcoholics Anonymous quit. Yeah. You see, up till now, it's been a snap. Hasn't really been anything that you've had to do. It's all being done for you. But now we're ready to go to work, fellas. We have to dig a hole. We have to dig a hole so that we can build a foundation. And digging is tough. Oh, yeah, it's tougher than hell. Especially if you're in clay or you hit surface water at about 18 inches. It's a bitch. And nobody likes that. Nobody likes that. The fourth step of our program is all about digging, too. One, two, and three were a snap. That got you over the dry heaves and the sickness in your ass coming out of your nose. Now you're sober and they want you to go to work. Dig. Take a good look at what the hell you really are. Discover the exact nature of your illness, of your wrongs. Oh, Jesus. I want to do all that shit. That's about the opposite. I get the hell out of here. I can do it on the first three steps, you know. And they quit. And they quit. But that's their business. Some of us stick around and we dig, and we dig. And we tend to want to shoot angles. You know, you're like me, you're down in Johnson City, Illinois, and you're taking a little job on the side to do on a weekend to pay a little bar bill or something like that. Going to build a four-stall firehouse for the Jefferson City Fire Department. Snap, you know, concrete blocks, bricks on one side, four doors, and a cheap-ass roof. Throw it up just like that with a couple of farmers. And then you discover a hell of a thing. You got a farmer in there on a Saturday when nobody's looking with an old manure loader digging your foundation. And all of a sudden he says, I can't get nothing out of here. There's a whole bunch of goddamn stumps in here. Stumps? What are you talking about? Well, you want me to dig this hole, boss? It's all tree stumps. You find out that years ago, the city of Johnson City had a little problem with something called Dutch elm disease. They cut down all their elm trees. They took all of these big stumps. They buried them on this city-owned lot that you're going to build a firehouse on. Well, hell, you've only allowed $500 for that farmer to dig that hole. It's going to cost you about $5,000 for dynamite to blow them things out of there. You're going to be in the hole before you start. So you begin to think, and we know that's the worst thing any alcoholic can do. Hell, I know what I do. Who the hell's going to know that them stumps are there? I'll just pour the concrete right over them. And if I can get the concrete all troweled off and finished before the inspector gets back here, he'll never know the difference. So you pour the concrete on a Sunday. Monday morning, the contractor shows up. Inspector, well, looks fine, got all troweled. Yeah, oh, hell, no problems at all. Great. And you build your building. And it looks lovely. You get paid. Wish the city council good luck. You go off on your way. And 7 years later, you're building McCormick Place up there in Chicago, Illinois, and a detective from the bonding company shows up. You Duffy? Yeah. What can I do for you? You build a firehouse down in Johnson City, Illinois? Yeah. You know them Dutch elm trees? They sprouted. Now you got two choices, Mr. Duffy. You're either going to pay it up or you're going to go to prison. What do you want? Show me where Johnson City, Illinois. When you dig that hole, you got to get all of the crap out of there. You can't shoot no angles. And it's the same thing when you're taking that fourth step. Don't hide nothing. Get it out. Get it out. But you never know when it's going to come back to haunt you. Tragically and sadly enough, I have known cases of guys in AA with 12, 13, 16 years of sobriety who lived with a guilt and stayed sober with a guilt because they never got it cleaned up. And then it hit them. 13 years of sobriety went right out the window. If they had done what they were told to do in the beginning, there wouldn't have been any sprouting. So when you take that inventory, get it all out and get that hole nice, neat, and you're ready. Now you're ready to sort of commit yourself to sobriety. Have I really want this thing, or is this just lip service? Am I doing this for my wife, my job, or what? Is my number one priority going to be me? Am I willing to go to any length? Will I listen? Have I done things right? Well, I got to know all of these things before I jump into this thing for good. And that's about how you feel, you know, the night before you're going to pour the concrete. You cement men know exactly what I'm talking about, don't you? You know what it's like the night before you pour concrete. You're a nervous wreck. You're wondering if everything you've done is right. Am I at the right height or have the right width? Am I on the right side of the street? You've got the engineer and the foreman and everybody out there checking everything you've done to make sure it's right. I got it braced right, snap ties in, the wall ties in, is everything in right? Leave the sleeves out for the plumbers, the electricians. Because at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, there's going to be about 16 of them big, ugly monsters backing up. They're going to stick that big tongue out, and down it's going to come. And when you say pour it, it better be right. And so you toss and you roll and you think you're right. And about 2 minutes to seven, you look at them trucks and you look at that thing. Yeah, this is what I want, pour it. And in it comes, in it comes. And you've jumped in with both feet now. And it creaks and it squeaks. And once in a while a tie breaks and you wonder and you hear somebody shout, ooh. But everything holds together. The concrete slowly comes to the top, to the level. And it's there. It's all there. It's right up here as far as it can go. It's filled up the hole. But hey, it's too soft to put anything on. You know, you don't jump in on top of wet concrete. You got to give it a little time to get hard. Doesn't get hard overnight, and it doesn't gain its strength in 1 week, 7 days, 14, or 21. They test it at those intervals. And as it's getting hard there in the beginning, you know, you begin to see little ripples up on the top. Little pebbles. You know, nothing big, no big deals. Just something that takes away the smoothness. So a cement finisher hops out there with a trowel. Just sort of trowels it down. Takes that little ripple out of there, that little problem. Then another cement finisher pushes down a couple of pebbles over here. And together they trowel. And they get it nice and smooth. The cement finishers in AA are all around you. They're sitting alongside of you tonight. They handle them little problems. It's the guy that's going to give you a ride home tonight. It's the guy that gave you a friendly hello when you came in. Somebody who said, keep coming back. Somebody said, can I get your cup of coffee? But don't let your wife upset you. It'll be all right. These are the cement finishers. And then pretty soon, you've got it. That's as far as AA is going to go. That's as far as AA can go. It can give you the foundation for your life. Now, I don't know what you want to do with your life. But there's a basic rule to life. And it was so well described by the late Floyd Bowers. And I don't know if there's anybody in here that ever remembers Floyd. Floyd was a circuit judge from Roseville. Very active, dedicated member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the outside chairman for the Folsom group for years. Some of you might have tapes of Floyd. Floyd always closed his talks with the recitation of that little poem, The Touch of the Master's Hand, about the violinist with the little stranger from the back came and took the violin. Floyd was a hell of a guy. And Floyd always told this antidote, which I think is so apropos to what point we're at here. Floyd mentioned how three vagrants were sort of stumbling through the garbage dumps up there in Roseville where he lived. And these three men, identical in stature, in size, in age, and in everything, were literally worth nothing, penniless, jobless, and almost hopeless. But as they wandered through the dumps, they came upon three identical blocks of steel, each exact same. And they each picked up one of these blocks of steel. So immediately they all became worth whatever that block of steel was worth. They all started out together. Now number one was in sort of a hurry, like a lot of people are in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want it all right now. So in his haste, he took his block of steel down to a blacksmith shop. And he said, I want you to make me some heads. For sledgehammers. They don't have to be fancy. They don't have to be tooled and dyed. The weight is the only thing that's important. Just hack them out of there as quick as you can. So I said, sure. And the blacksmith went to work, and he chopped out 4 heads for sledgehammers. 500 of them. The guy said, thanks. Now, the next guy took a little longer. He made 5,000 heads for carpenter's hammers because he took his block of steel down to a tool and die shop, and they made a die, and they cast a die, and they grind it, and they used a little bit of precision. And because they were smaller, he got 5,000 of them out of the same block of steel. Now, the last guy took a lot of time and was very patient, and he made surgical needles for doctors to use in surgery. And he took them to a precision tool place and honed and perfected these needles very carefully. And because they were so small, he got 50,000 of them out of the same block of steel. They all put a dollar value on each item. And it's obvious. The more you put into it, the more you're going to get out of it. If that doesn't sound AA, you haven't been there. Thank you.